You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond, grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in sunny Fairfield, Iowa, on this beautiful December 18th. What a day.
Beautiful day. Beautiful
and day. This is Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley. With me is my mom and co-host, Caroline Kilborn, who is... has been on the radio for how many years? 40 years?
Oh, gosh. That's about what?
1972, maybe, is when you started your career in radio?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so that's actually...
there was a few stops in there for a while. That's a lifetime ago.
So welcome to Writer's Voices. And, Mom, who do we have with us today?
Well, today we have a author, Ellen Hopkins, and she is a number one New York Times best-selling author of Crank, Burned, Impulse Glass, Identical, Tricks, Fallout, Perfect, Tilt, Smoke, and Rumble. Interesting titles, huh? And as well as the adult movies, Triangles.
Or novels.
Adult novels, Triangles, Collateral, and the forthcoming Love Lies Beneath. And today we are talking about Traffic, which is it's a very timely topic, and it's very sad, but you got to know about it. You just got to know about it because you have to stop it.
Tell us a little bit more about Ellen.
Okay, she lives with her family in Carson City, Nevada, where she has founded Ventana Sierra, a nonprofit youth housing and resource initiative. And you can visit her at ellenhopkins.com and on Facebook and follow her on Twitter.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Ellen.
Thanks for having me.
So for people who are not familiar with your work, most of these books are poetry, correct?
Right. It's called novels in verse or verse novel. And it's basically a hybrid of fiction and narrative verse.
And very easy to read.
They are. It's well, you know, it's funny because sometimes the people that really love to read in a more linear fashion have a harder time with it. And it tends to be even reluctant readers who pick it up and go, wow, this is awesome. Mm-hmm. Like the format. So,
yeah. Oh, that's
interesting. It reads like fiction. I mean, I think if you just pick up the books and read them, they read like more like fiction than they do like poetry.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
But there is something different about it as opposed to your normal, just picking up a normal novel.
Well, it is. And for me, it's, because I'm a poet, you know, I've been a poet for a long time, so it's word choice, it's poetic devices, it's having the spare language on the page. Actually, what I'm told often and what I think happens is it tends to put you inside the characters' heads. So it's like you're viewing their world rather than you're being told about their world. That's what it feels like to read it this way, because poetry is about how the poet views the world. So if the characters are speaking in poetry, then you're seeing how they are viewing their world.
Now, how did you come to write in this format or this genre? It's not something that's really common today.
It's not. I mean, there are a few of us doing it, and I've pretty much taken it to a different place. First of all, it's an ancient form of storytelling, right? It's
right.
Oh, yeah.
Homer and Chaucer and Joyce and, you know, Shakespeare. But it was really repopularized, I think, by a book called Out of the Dust by Karen Hess, which was a Newbery winner, and I think it was 1990. That's kind of on a little bit younger level. It's a middle grade book about the Dust Bowl. And that book kind of brought the idea to the forefront again, that you could storytell in this fashion.
And is that where, did you get the idea of doing that from that book? Was that your original inspiration?
No, actually, it's another verse novelist, Sonia Soans, who had written a book about her sister's schizophrenia, and she wrote it in verse. And it really worked so well because you were inside her head and you could really just, you could see how her thoughts jumbled, you know? And so that was the book that kind of gave me the inspiration for Crank, which is my first novel in verse.
You know, this brings to mind something that I read in college. A poem should not mean, but be. And I think these qualify for that.
I agree. I mean, I think where people that think they don't like poetry, I think where poetry fails for them is when they have to work too hard to discover meaning.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And yeah. I've been a member of a poetry group here in Carson City for about 25 years now, and our de facto leader, who passed away a few years ago, but he was the one that really stressed how accessible poetry should be. You know, that you should be able to understand the poem without having to, you know, dissect it for an hour.
Now, it does seem like poetry may take longer to write than prose. Do you find that to be true?
It's absolutely true. I have 15 novels out. The last adult novel, Love Lies Beneath, was the first one in prose, and it wrote so much quicker. You know, I'm like, how did I get so many words down so quickly? And that's why. Mm. So for me, in the writing process, every, you know, word choice is vital. So I could stress over a stanza or the right word or even just a page for, you know, an hour or more. So it's very precise as I'm doing the writing. And so it's kind of a slow process on this end. On the far end, I only do one draft. So because each poem, like, flows very specifically one into the next, like the title from one is really, you know, the next line after the page before. So it's all revision on the far end is really hard. So I try to get it as right as I can before I send it off to my editor.
Wow.
It's interesting. It really is.
Yeah. Now, why don't we talk a little bit about what traffic is about, and then sort of backtrack in how your other books and how it led to this.
Okay, so Traffic is the sequel to Trix, which came out about 5 years ago, I guess. They're both about domestic minor sex trafficking, so teen prostitution or, you know, trafficking young people for sex. And with Trix, what inspired me to do that was, so my background before I got into writing novels is I was a freelance journalist for a number of years, and then I wrote nonfiction books for young readers. And so that kind of nonfiction background, I become interested in facts or statistics that I come across. And so I came across this statistic that the average age of a young person being trafficked for sex was 12 years old. So when something like that strikes me, then I need to go out and figure out why. And so then, there's a lot of research into what would bring kids that young and put them on the street. And that's kind of what inspired me to write Trix. And then Traffic. So Trix is about five young people from all different parts of the country, very different life circumstances, that end up on the streets of Las Vegas turning tricks. At the end of that book, they've all been pulled out. One's been arrested. One's been put into rehab. One has been shot. And so they're all pulled out. And so Traffic is about, where that's about, Trix is about victimization, Traffic is about survivorship. So it's about, can you move forward, can you go home, can you find love again with this book.
Did you actually talk to people that are in this life?
Quite a few, yeah. With Trix, I worked with Las Vegas Vice, talking to young people that were on the street. And then with Traffic, I worked with survivors. So helping survivors write their own stories. And I have a pretty broad young adult readership at this point where I kind of feel like to a lot of my readers, like sort of like, I think I'm like the Dear Abby of YA Lit. So they come to me and they share their stories, even unsolicited. They'll come and they'll go, well, let me tell you my story. And those stories, some of them are pretty heart-wrenching. Mm-hmm. So all five characters, main characters, plus all the peripheral stories you get in Traffic, which are other survivors, those are all inspired by real people or real stories.
Wow. I mean, when you're talking to these people, don't you just want to save them all?
You do. I mean, this is a really hard place to get pulled out of and to be able to feel like you have a future, like you can get out of this trade business and have a future that looks like a normal future. So it takes a lot of support, and you do. You just want to hug them and go, look, you can get out, you can create your own future even beyond this.
Yeah. Well, Ellen, let's go back to your first book, Crank. What was that about?
So Crank is the story that actually got me into writing young adult lit as it is. I was working writing nonfiction, and my daughter, so I have, Crank is inspired by my daughter's story of meth addiction. So she was this kid, 150 IQ, she was going places, she was beautiful, she just had everything going for her, fell in with the wrong crowd, you know, with the wrong guy first and then the wrong crowd, and all these big dreams she had, all what she wanted was the Art Institute of Seattle, she wanted to get out and do computer animation, she had that all online, you know, it was up and coming for her. And instead, I mean, we've been 20 years now struggling with this addiction with her. So in and out of, you know, relapse and good phases and whatever. So at one point, she went to prison. And when she went to prison, I kind of needed, first of all, for me to make sense of, you know, what happened to my kid, what happened to, it was 6 years at that point, what happened to 6 years of our lives. And so I started Crank for me. And then through the writing process, it became clear, first of all, that I needed to write it for young adults, because what I really wanted from the book, and I know it has accomplished, is to turn young people away from that choice if possible. So I write, it's a very, very honest look at the path to addiction, how easily it can happen, but also, you know, the damage it's done, not just to the addict, but to the family of the addict. It's a trilogy now, so it's Crank, Glass, and then Fallout, which is from the points of view of her children. So, you know, the addict's children. And I just, it was crucial to me to write it for myself, but also for this audience that, you know, to offer insight into, look, after a while it is the drug talking, it's not the person that's left your life. And a lot of my readers aren't addicts themselves, but they might have lost a parent to addiction or a friend to addiction or a boyfriend to addiction or whatever. And so this book has been, I mean, there are, you know, a couple million copies in print around the world. I mean, it's a big, huge book that, who knew, you know?
Wow. When you started writing this, had you had a book published at all, or was that your first published book?
That was my first novel. I had 20 nonfiction books for young readers.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I was, you know, I thought I was going to write picture books or whatever, and that's not my skill set. I have tried picture books. It's not my skill.
Okay.
Entire story arcs in 500 words just doesn't work for me. And then I thought I might write horror or something. You know, I was always kind of a big Stephen King, Dean Koontz kind of fan, and so I was writing short horror. I was writing fiction. I just wasn't publishing a lot of it at that point. Publishing poetry, but I wasn't publishing fiction.
Is it fair to say that in many cases, these young people have no idea how easy it is to get addicted?
Oh, absolutely not. Especially, and meth is one of these ones, and, you know, because I had to do the research into the, you know, the physiology of the drug and how it works on the brain, which is why it's as addictive as it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, truly, you can get addicted using it just a time or two, and it's just the brain chemistry part of that. And so, you know, to have a real clear view, see, I think, like when I go in, I do a lot of high school visits. I go in and I talk to young people a lot. And I think those kind of visits are probably more helpful than like the DARE program to a group of high school kids, because to see what a real story and to have a real understanding of what's at stake and you know, how hurt people, not just again, the addict, but the people around them can become. I think it's eye-opening for young people to see that and to get this kind of understanding of, you know, look, I could do this once and I could end up like that.
Was it hard for you to share so much of your pain on the page that way?
you know, for me, I it just poured out. The story poured out. The biggest part of the writing process was just developing the format. So I started the book in prose, and I wanted to write first person from her point of view, not my point of view. And in prose, it was my voice. It was not her voice. Christina is the character, but very much my daughter. It was not her voice. It was bitter and angry, and that's not what I wanted at all. So I put the book away, and I actually went and did a workshop with Sonia. And that's where I'm like, okay, I'm going to try it this way. And it worked really well. I highly stylized it, where Sonia kind of writes more standard stanzas. I highly stylized Crank, a lot of concrete poetry. When her thoughts would scatter, I could scatter words across the page. So there's a real visual interest to it, which, again, is helpful for reluctant readers to have something that draws them in besides big blocks of text. And a lot of the reluctant readers are the exact kids that I wanted to reach. So it was just, everything was, the timing was right on everything with the book, with the story, with my poetry. You know, it just all worked. And see, I kind of feel like this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Like I was put here to do this.
Wow. Now, when you talk about like the visual element in Traffic, you have scattered throughout the book, there's poems that have a certain... I'm sure that there's a word for the format that they're in, where the last word of each stanza is offset and also reads down to form its own theme,
right.
Basically.
I'm sure I'm not the only one that's ever done that, but it's something I was developing in my regular adult, you know, just standalone poetry. And that's kind of something that become a signature style, so you'll find those pretty much in all my books, and the kids love those, you know, and in fact, a lot of times teachers will have them try to write them, because, you know, it looks like it's easy.
It looks pretty hard. It definitely
I'm consuming, too.
Yeah.
One book, yeah. Identical, which is about identical twins, and every time I change voices between the two of them, I pull those poems, the little poems in towards, we called them gutter poems, the gutter of the book. And the little poems were the same because, you know, the inside of the twins were the same, but the bigger poems were different because they're different people. That was, I kept, every time I'd come to that time, I'd be like, why am I doing this? I don't know why I'm doing this, but, you know, it worked really well, so.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Ellen Hopkins, the author of Traffic, and that's spelled with the K at the end, the sequel to Tricks. What does the K at the end signify?
It's, you know, if you put the ING on, then get to it. It was just a kind of for a visual interest and to let you know that it's about that rather than about being stuck on the freeway.
And so all your books have these very short, intense titles. Did you always think, you know, when you, the first one, how did you come up with the first title, and then did that just lead to all the other titles?
Yeah, and Crank was originally called Flirting with the Monster, which is like the title of the first poem in there. But my editor didn't want it to get confused with a horror book. So they said, it was her title, actually. She's like, let's just call it what it is, which is Crank. And that's such a punchy, you know, and that book cover, the original, is just black with the word written like lines, you know, like lines of drugs.
Well, actually, it is a horror story, but, you know.
Simple and so dynamic. I mean, the designer won a big award for the cover. You know, and when it came, you know, you get the covers flat first when you're seeing them, right? And it came, and I'm like, My husband's like, are you kidding? It's brilliant. I'm like, okay. And then it's, you know, becomes sort of a branding thing where,
let's
do the single word titles and the book covers. There's no, like, you know, people on the cover. There's no girls holding their heads or, you know, whatever. You know, YA covers kind of get kind of dramatic sometimes or melodramatic. These are dramatic in a different way, in that they're just dynamic, you know. And the branding part of it is, like, you know, if someone sees the traffic cover across a bookstore, it's going to look like an Ellen Hopkins cover. Plus, the trim size is interesting.
Yeah, it is an unusual size for a book. Was that, are all your books in that size too?
They are, until you get to the trade paper now is bigger.
Okay,
All the hardcovers are the same size.
And what was, why was that choice made to make, because it's smaller than a normal hardcover, but thick. You know, so
right. And the thick is also because there are fewer words on the page, which makes more pages overall.
Right,
anyway.
Right.
But they're the same approximate word count as, you know, most kind of young adult novels are, around 75,000 words, somewhere in there. But I think whoever the designer was just decided to try something different. It was funny, too, because, you know, when I first started doing it, you know, you open up a Word doc and it's 8.5 by 11, like a regular piece of paper, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in the revision side, you know, when they would come back from copy edit and whatever, they would be all broken up weird. It took me 3 books to get that if I wrote to trim size, that, you know, we wouldn't have to do all that redesign on
them. Ah!
So now I write to trim size in the right font size, and I know what it's going to look like on the page.
Oh, perfect. Now, you talked a lot about your first book, Crank, and about that it's really about your daughter. How did she feel about having her life exposed on the page that way?
When I first started writing it, she was in prison, and she was coming down. I mean, she, again, this was 6 years of meth addiction, and it took almost a year for her to get all the way clean. You know, to get all the drug out of her system, to have her thoughts kind of starting to work right again. So I let her know, but I didn't talk to her a lot. You know, there were phone calls once in a while. I let her know I was doing it. She was kind of indifferent to it, I guess. And then when she got out and she was clean, she gave me more of the stories in the sequel, Glass.
Mm.
So Crank, none of those stories came from her. They came from friends, from letters from the boyfriend I found, from her sister, who she confided a lot of stuff in. And then, of course, it's fictionalized because I wasn't there for everything. And I did change characters. You know, there were composites of people, or they were changed in whatever ways, to give a little bit of space. All the major plot points happened, though, in all those books. So.
Wow.
She was okay with it once she got into a better place. And you know, I was very clear in Crank that it was based on our story because I never wanted anybody to say it couldn't happen this way.
Oh.
Because it did.
Wow.
And also because I felt like it made it more powerful to know that this is something that happened. It wasn't something I just made up, you know. And I thought that honesty was important.
You know, you talked about the brain development and so forth. Of course, in young people, their brains are not fully developed. And they also think they're invincible. So those two factors, I'm sure, add to the whole complex thing.
Well, and the problem is, you know, because the drug, it's manufactured with caustic chemicals, right? So there's an active ingredient, which is the speed part that gets you high, but To distill it, they manufacture it with, like, acetone and lye. And so those drugs, I mean, those chemicals, when you ingest the drug, those chemicals go into your bloodstream, too, and they actually eat it. Like, if you see pictures of meth addicts and their teeth are bad,
yeah,
it's because the chemicals have gone down into the roots of their teeth and rotted them from the inside out. So anywhere that you have, you have veins going, those chemicals are going through. So for her, she has lung damage and brain damage. So the drugs, the chemicals actually ate into the part of the brain, which is the pleasure center, which, you know, that's how the drug acts on you. So she has lost some of her emotional ability to love and to, you know, to have the kind of pleasure that you have. You know, she doesn't get adrenaline rushes the same way anymore. Mm-hmm. She doesn't feel great about, you know, having a good job, or, you know, those are the things that you lose when you use that the drug for very long.
Wow. Yeah, I always said, you know, I raised two kids, and fortunately I didn't have any addiction troubles, but did have other issues that that were very challenging. And I said, you know, we spend the first 10 years of our kids' lives convincing them that nothing bad can ever happen to them. Or, you know, protecting them and telling them that nothing bad will ever happen.
And believing that yourself.
No, I don't know that you necessarily believe it, but you want your child to feel safe and protected.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You want them to feel like nothing bad can ever happen. And then we wonder why, when they get to be teenagers, they think nothing bad is going to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
And it's why I really wish parents would actually, you know, pick up my books and read them with their teenagers. With them, and so that they can communicate, you know, about, because I'm writing edgy contemporary YA, that's what I write, and so I'm writing teen suicide, you know, what brings a teen to the brink of suicide, you know, why do they feel this kind of despair, but these are important conversations to have with your kids, you know, sexual abuse, why, we need to talk.
Oh, yeah.
You know, again, about choices. You make this choice, this is what could happen, you know? Or if something bad happens to you, please say something. You know, it's like for years and years and years and years, until just probably the last, I don't know, 15 years maybe, we didn't encourage young people to speak up or women to speak up if they've been abused or raped or, you know, any of these issues.
Yeah.
In fact, they were told to shut up.
Yeah.
You know? Just be quiet about it. And you can't. You have to say something, and you have to say something sooner rather than later. And so, you know, I feel like I'm giving a voice to a lot of young people who felt like they didn't have a voice. And I hear that from them. You know, I mean, I get reader letters a lot.
Oh, I bet.
I hear that from them.
Now, when you're writing about these really tough subjects, do you get emotionally drawn into this black hole?
I feel like I channel my characters. Mm-hmm. What pulls me down sometimes are my readers' letters, because, you know, these are things we want to assume don't happen to young people. You know, I have them. I keep them, in fact, for book challenges, because I get challenged pretty regularly.
What do you mean you get challenged?
Like book banning kind of challenges.
Oh, wow.
I am regularly on those lists. My book
and me is
and an author. But because, again, I think book challenges come from a place where adults...
They don't want to believe this happens.
They don't want to believe it happens. And they also figure, some of them think if we just be quiet about it, then it's going to go away.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't work that way, you know?
No.
We arm our kids with knowledge, not with ignorance. So...
And the thing is, it isn't that it just started happening in the last 15 years. These things have been going on for a long, long time. I have a friend who was essentially trafficked as a young girl by a family member.
And I've heard from readers, okay, my mom pimped me out when I was 10 for her drug habit. You know, and these stories are much more common than you think they are. They just are. And I don't know.
Yeah.
It's to pretend that this stuff doesn't happen is the wrong approach, in my not so humble opinion.
Yeah.
I really truly believe it's not the right approach. The best approach is to arm your kids with knowledge.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Ellen Hopkins, the number one New York Times bestselling author of Traffic, which is a sequel to Tricks. And Ellen, I think I read somewhere that you are the best-selling poet in the USA today.
Yeah, Billy Collins is not happy about that. and that's, you know, I guess what they're saying, four or 5 million books in print now, so...
And most poets...
I probably am.
yeah, and most...
I don't know, you know, I don't think about that, really.
Most poets would be happy to sell 10,000 books.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. But, you know, this is a great, it's a great format. It's a great way of storytelling. I think there's room for other people that would like to try it, for sure.
We interviewed Jacqueline Woodson last year, who Brown Girl Dreaming is written in verse. And I think she won the National Book
Jackie,
Award.
Jackie, I think she has other books in verse as well.
Yeah.
She's an amazing woman. I know her pretty well.
And and that book was wonderful too. And it does seem like young adult is, it's maybe more open to this format. Do you think that's true?
I do. I think adult readers tend to get turned off by poetry somewhere along the line. You know, little kids love it. You know, we got Dr. Seuss, we have Shel Silverstein. Mm-hmm. You know, little kids love it. Around middle school, then it's like, I don't know, maybe that's a little corny. I don't know. So I'm glad that verse novel is kind of, you know, opening up the idea of poetry. And, you know, I love working with young people and going in and having them write their stories in poetry. And a lot of times it comes out kind of rap-like or, you know, music-like, because that's what they're used to listening to. And that's certainly valid.
Oh,
poetry to so many kids anyway.
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes I'll listen to a rap song and I'm blown away by the rhythm and the word choice and the poetry incorporated into that. It's just amazing to me.
Yeah, and young people, I mean, like, sometimes I get blown away by the stuff they do. I'm like, whoa. You know, you keep doing this, you got a career, boy.
Wow.
You know.
Yeah. Well, Ellen, let's talk a little bit more about the characters in Traffic. So you have five characters, and they all came to this life from very different places. So, let's start with Eden.
So Eden is from a very religious family. Her mother is way overbearing, not a very nice woman, a very cold woman, and she ends up, because Eden falls in love, and this is because they are one religion, and Eden falls in love with the boy who's Catholic, and when she won't break up with him, her mother puts her in a rehab camp, a rehabilitation camp of sorts, where actually bad things happen to her in the camp, and she runs away from there, and that's how she ends up in Vegas. That character was inspired by a real story that was told to me at a book signing in Boise. And in the book, she's Assemblies of God. In real life, she was Mormon, and her Mormon mother locked her away for 2 years in a mental hospital.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So would you like to read some of Eden's?
Sure. Eden's the one at the end, okay. Okay, so Eden. Screaming into the silence, no one to hear the brittle cries but shadows thrown against the walls, and I burrow my face into the quilt to shut out the demon dance. This nightmare I can't escape walks and breathes beyond the confines of sleep, and with it a monster impossible to forget, grinning, leering, whispering lust-infused ballads through serrated teeth. He carries in his hand a perfect strawberry, offers it like treasure, and when I bend to taste it, he smashes it into my face. Walk Straight was a godsend to me, maybe even literally. I'd been sleeping on the streets, crashing behind dumpsters, offering myself up to passers-by for meager money, barely enough to eat. I would say survive, but that requires being alive, and I was one of the walking dead when I threw a plea skyward, please, God, please, if it's your will, show me the way out. It wasn't God who actually answered, but a priest in the Catholic Church I had sleepwalked into. How can I help you, he asked, trying not to look disgusted by the odor clinging to the awful Salvation Army clothes I wore. I didn't know how he could help, but once he had no doubt about my circumstances, Father Gregory knew exactly how. He sent me here to Walk Straight, a rescue for teen prostitutes intent on a better life.
And does, so Eden really didn't, you know, didn't want to be there, to be on the street at all.
No, no. She had no idea what to do or how to survive other than, and she was sleeping on the street.
Wow.
Do any of these young people want to be there? I mean, you think they do?
I don't think any of them want to be there, no.
No.
And I think even in real life, even the ones that in some way think they want to be there, they don't. Because they're too young to know better. They don't have the perspective to understand.
Yeah.
The ones that say they want to be there just know no other life. And mm-hmm. in fact, usually they're the ones who's, maybe their mom is a prostitute, or you know they've been in business that way, that it's almost a family kind of business, or they've been in it so long that they just don't think there's anything else available to them.
Wow. Now, one of the characters, I think maybe it was Ginger, who goes to court and. The judge, you know, basically says you're a victim, and that was a surprise to her.
Yeah, and I think probably a lot of sex workers don't look at themselves as victims. You know, she ran away from home because her mother pimped her out, and she found that out. She thought she'd been raped, but when she found out that her mother sold her, she ran, and so for her, because that experience was so bad, the rape experience. She won't let men touch her, but the way she survives is by stripping for money mm-hmm. In hotel rooms and stuff. And so for her, she saw it as that she chose to do that, and so she didn't see herself as a victim. Now, see, this is a big change that we've had in our perception of especially minors being trafficked. We are seeing them as victims. The courts are looking at them as victims instead of as criminals. They're putting meat into the sentencing of pimps specifically, and some as far as Johns. At least they're giving Johns a hard time. You know, if we didn't have a market for it, there wouldn't be this problem, and it's a big problem. It's the statistic here is like on any given day in this country, between 150,000 and 300,000 young people being trafficked for sex. That's a big problem.
Yeah. It does really boggle my mind that there are that many people who want that.
It's not a problem, it's an epidemic.
Yeah. It's like you said, if there weren't a market for it, wouldn't be happening.
Yeah,
and
right.
I mean, who are these people who are buying? Have you ever thought about writing from that perspective?
That would be an interesting perspective. It really would.
It would.
You know, a lot of those people were victimized themselves as young people.
Oh.
There's the psychology of it's pretty compelling. I don't know who all of them are. You know, and the thing about it is the internet has made it a lot easier as well. So they don't actually have to put them all out on the street now. They can advertise them on Craigslist or, you know, some of these other lists that they have, and then they just send them to their hotel rooms.
Do you have any suggestions for what to do, how to help with this problem?
It's awareness is a big thing. You know, as adults, we have to be aware. If you see something that doesn't look right, if it looks like there's a young person being, it's something that you can recognize. It's not like you can't. Then there are hotlines that they're included in my book. I have them. There are hotlines you can call or even do it just online anonymously so that you can just say, look, I think something's going on here, or I think this person looks like she's either a runaway or she's, you know, on the street for whatever reason. Parents need to be hyper aware of changes in their kids' behavior that could indicate something like this, because, I mean, there are girls that prostitute themselves from home, and they do it for things like, some of them work for pimps, some of them just do it. so they can earn some extra money for to buy a pair of designer jeans that they might not be able to afford, or it could be a drug habit, or there are a lot of different reasons why. But parents need to be aware. If your children's friends have changed, or if their grades are slipping like dramatically, or if they're truant when they used to not be truant, I mean, those kind of behaviors are signs of something wrong, and you need to know.
And some of the characters in Traffic had parents who, or family members at least, who wanted to be there for them.
Right. Right. But a lot of times kids don't know that, you know?
Yeah.
Like your parents or when you're a teenager, for whatever reason, your parents become the enemy for a while until, you know, hopefully you'll come back around.
Yeah.
I don't know, I've raised three to adulthood and I have an 18-year-old now, and he's just coming back around now.
Congratulations.
Yeah. He went through that whole, you know, I hate you, I hate you.
Oh.
And now he's like, well, maybe I only dislike you. No, he's a great kid.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, I felt that way, even though my mom really was not my enemy. It feels like, you know, you want to be doing things with your friends, and maybe your parents don't want you doing them, so bad guy.
Yeah. Well, Ellen, why don't you read some more from the book?
Okay. So I will read, I'll read Seth right now.
All right.
Okay. And I think you get who Seth is pretty much from these first couple poems. My soul has taken a vacation, hitched a ride somewhere cool and clean, maybe the mountains. I haven't seen it in months. Perhaps it's deserted me permanently. I should feel bad, but I can't muster sympathy for the boy become man who is me. Man, gay man, kept man, you'll find the ultimate meaning of that term in the eyes of every boy forced by circumstance to sacrifice the truth of himself. I keep digging for truth, but can't seem to find it in me. I swore I'd never get used to living like this, at the beck and call and under almost total control of another human being. I say almost because after Carl, my ex-sugar daddy, when I moved in here with David, I knew enough to find a way to stash some cash in case I ever needed an escape plan. Carl, who brought me with him from Louisville, a trophy houseboy to decorate his Lake Las Vegas luxury condo, allowed me no chance at personal resources. He wanted ownership. Slavery is alive and thriving in Sin City, Nevada. Maybe that's why I gambled on connecting with hot stranger in the gym, Jared, the growing need for rebellion, or at least a taste of autonomy. Or maybe it was simply because I'm only 18 and still stashed inside is the belief that love waits for me somewhere.
Okay, and who's next?
And then we can go, we'll do Ginger.
Okay.
Will I walk away from here, this dirty city where people come in search of lady luck, certain she'll guide them to the fortune she owes them, or to shed their skins, reveal the extraordinary creatures beneath, aliens they struggle to conceal from spouses, ministers, their local PTA? Will I walk away from her, my best friend turned lover, before our tumble from enlightenment, if such a thing ever belonged to me? Can I excise her from my heart as easily as she deserted me? If I opened my arms, begged her to return, would she come back or would she turn and run? How can I leave here without her, Alex, my sweet Alex? At least she was sweet until Las Vegas claimed her, made her its bitch. This city is a pimp selling fantasies. For a time, Alex and I were a fantasy duet, working for Have Your Cake Escort Service, despite being a couple of years underage. 18 isn't necessary to participate in a business that props up the underbelly of Vegas. It was not what I had in mind when I ran away, but then again, I had no plan, and sometimes it comes down to survival. We survived, stripping for pay in hotel rooms, mostly working bachelor parties, two for the price of one. I insisted on that, refused to do more than take off my clothes and dance. But Alex couldn't care less about spreading her legs and accepting foreign objects as long as the dudes were willing to pay the going rate. Then she got greedy, started working the streets so she wouldn't have to kick back Lydia's commission. I found her out there soliciting some guy wearing ugly purple Bermuda shorts. That pissed me off, but in hindsight, looking for revenge by offering to let him buy all he could eat double-decker wasn't the smartest move. Turned out he was a cop on a trash run, prowling for teen hookers. Vegas has issued stern orders, get them off the sidewalks, bust their pimps and even their johns. Detective Bermuda Shorts was only doing his job. Tell me who's sending you out. The court will go easy on you. Alex and I didn't roll on Lydia or have your cake. Luckily, Judge Carey was sympathetic anyway, and honest to goodness, do-gooder. Nevada considers trafficking children a serious offense. This is not a victimless crime, and you, young lady, are a victim.
Okay, let me ask you this. Now, of course, you know Vegas is a large city, but this is large cities are not the only place where this is happening, right?
Absolutely not. In fact, it's kind of easy to pick up young girls. You know, they're boys too, but boys tend to be on the street more as runaways. They've been forced out of their house or, you know, just turned out on the street. Girls tend to be the ones that pimps will sweet talk into falling in love with them, basically, and that happens a lot, that these young girls who maybe not getting enough attention at home or people aren't paying attention to them or whatever are kind of easily sucked in under these. And pimps are, you know, good-looking men. They seem reasonable until they don't. Often they'll get them hooked on drugs or hooked on them or whatever, and then it's really, really hard for them to get out. But small towns, absolutely, small cities. And there's a circuit that they move a lot of these young people on, and they can be big cities, but they can also be small towns.
Mm. Okay, who else do we have?
We have Cody. Where are you, Cody?
And Cody's one who did have a supportive mother and girlfriend.
Cody got into it because as his stepfather is dying of cancer, so there's a lot of money going out of their house and bills. Cody developed a gambling habit, and he was taking money out of his mom's bank account that he couldn't figure out how to put back. And she was, I mean, they were hurting for money, and he was the one doing it. And so this was his way of trying to put some money back. And Cody, at the end of Trix, has been shot by a John, actually. Can't find the courage to leap the brink, free fall beyond the precipice, hurtle toward the abyss, end the pain. Mine, mom's. Oh, she'd feel the initial sting, cry for a day or two, but it would be short-lived, a quick stab of grief, finite. A satin-lined coffin and cool, deep hole are preferable to walking a treadmill over a carpet of coals, enduring the blistering, skin-crackling flames of this living hell. Awake. A slow swim toward the light, breaking the surface to crawl back onto the beach here in the land of the living. It seems like a worthy goal, so why do I wish I'd died instead? Should that be the first thought to pop into my head, I open my eyes, snap them shut again. I've been treading dark water for, I have no idea how long. I test the light again, and the fluorescent glare against white walls makes me bury my head in the pillow. Bleach stink assaults me immediately, fights the antiseptic smell that confirms I'm in a hospital. Hospital, yes. That information sinks through the fog, licking inside my head, sinks with the onslaught of noises, monitors beeping, ventilators whooshing, and somewhere there's a game show on TV. Tubes jet from my arms and some sort of brace wraps my midsection, limiting movement, but I manage to swivel my head toward the rhythmic snore marking time very near my right elbow. Mom's dozing on a gray plastic chair beside the bed. Her voice floats from memory. Come back to me, Cody boy. Don't you dare leave me too. And I remember her hands, oh God, soft as rose petals and fragranced the same way as she stroked my face over and over, urging, please, son, we'll make it through this. We always make it through, but I can't do it alone. I want to help her make it through. I want to go back to sleep. Except I finally accomplished what she's been waiting for. Resurrection. Mom, I have to force the word through a thick soup of phlegm, and it exits my mouth, a hoarse whisper. She doesn't stir until I clear my throat. Cody? She mumbles, and her eyes stutter open and to find my own staring at her. Cody, are you really here? She jerks upright. Oh, my God. She jumps to her feet, rushes bedside, and grabs my hand. Too hard, a wicked buzz, like a static shock, zaps the base of my skull.
And Cody's got maybe the hardest road ahead, seems like.
He does. Yeah. He has a spinal cord injury from where the bullet nicked his spine. And through that, which is funny because it's interesting because he in Trix was probably he had the least ambition I guess out of all the characters, and so he has to become ambitious to fight this thing or it will eat him up.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, and that leaves Whitney.
That does leave Whitney. So Whitney, again, she's the one who was a wealthy girl, and she was lured by a pimp. Need rises up from a bottomless well of longing, a whining so insistent no amount of willpower can force it silent. They say the way to be strong when confronted with the siren's song is to shutter your ears, fight the darkness, reach for the light. But the windows are draped with memories of ecstasy. A chat with a Grim Reaper should be enough to scare away any thought of relapse. Wish it were that easy, but not even days conversing with death can disintegrate the claws of addiction. My memory banks are foggy, misted by months held fast in the arms of the lady, squeezed by a need you can't describe, can't relate to unless you've experienced it. I barely remember that last fix, Mexican black tar instead of my usual China white. The lady, she took me on one hell of a ride before we dove over the cliff, falling, 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 falling in slow motion. Overdosing on heroin is ugly business. While the initial rush is truly incredible, similar, I imagine, to a military jet taking off, throwing you back in your seat as you climb, almost perpendicular to the ground. Yeah, close to that. But then the noise, a hurricane inside your head, blowing, pounding, exploding. You try to fight the bad wind, and everything slows. Your breathing, your heart, slow, slower. You can't find air as you drift toward darkness.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Ellen Hopkins. She was reading from Traffic, which is the sequel to Trix.
Did anyone ever ask you to put these poems on a voice type of thing? I mean, to read them and then...
Yeah, are they available as a book on tape?
They are, yeah.
And do you read it or does somebody else?
I don't read it. We've had a couple companies on with Simon & Schuster now with their own audio department, and they do some really great stuff. They do different readers for different characters, which is nice.
Mm.
So they have the ability to do that.
Right.
I've done some kind of just a little bit, you know, reading like stuff, but not the whole thing.
Right. Now, what about film? Has there ever been any talk of making a movie of any of these books?
There's been some. Identical was optioned for a while, but... It's hard to a lot of producers have a hard time seeing how to translate the verse into script.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I can see that.
It's interior. There's a lot of interior monologue and stuff. I did adapt Crank to the stage last year.
Oh, really? How did that work?
And it worked. I mean, we did it. I did it for a Reno theater group had me do it, and it was fabulous. It was amazing. I mean, and the girl that played Christina, she was awesome. And she was like in almost every scene because it is a lot of interior stuff, but she was awesome. And I can send a link if you want to that. We filmed it and use it for like fundraising for Ventana Sierra for our nonprofit.
Oh, I'd love to see that. We only have a few minutes, so tell us a little bit about your nonprofit.
So like in my travels, again, I talk to a lot of kids, and a lot of times I'll run into young people who don't have the who want college but don't have the resources. Like either they don't have family support or they don't have financial support or whatever. So we're helping at-risk kids. A lot of them are aged out of foster or on the street for whatever reason. We give them housing, food, clothing, and a way into college, a way into higher education, which to further career goals. You know, hopefully we're helping to build a little bit stronger future through that. We've helped some 25 kids into college at this point in the last 3 years, and that's been quite the journey.
I bet. I just have to ask, are any of your books have a lighter subject matter? Like identical?
Well, like the one I'm writing now is probably a little bit lighter in a way. It's but I mean, I don't write. This one's about parental alienation. So when a child is, you know, when there's an absent parent and a child has been kind of brainwashed by the custodial parent, to believe that that other parent doesn't want anything to do with them.
Oh.
So that's kind of what this book's about. This girl that has been told something for 17 years and she discovers all that's a lie.
Wow.
So I don't know if it's lighter, but
yeah.
Well, it's a little lighter maybe.
Like you said, you feel like you were put here to tell these stories and to open these conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, yeah. And when I write short stories and stuff, they tend to go darker even because I like to write horror. I don't know. And I'm a pretty happy, nice person. People always go, "Ah, you're just so nice."
I know. I have written some pretty dark stories in the past. And I remember one time I showed them to a new boyfriend and he, like, did not want to read them. He's like, "I had no idea you were like that." It's like, well, I'm not. It's just a story.
Somebody's got to write it.
Yeah.
Maybe we just write the dark thread of us out. You know?
Yeah, exactly. So, Ellen, I'm going to give the website for Ventana Sierra. It's VENTANASIERRA.org, because sometimes people are looking for donations to make at the end of the year to save taxes, and it sounds like this might be a really good organization to donate to.
It would be, yeah, we can always use help, of course, but that's the fundraising part of it is not, that's not what I'm good at. Math is not, not good. And, I do all my math with words.
Yeah.
And we urge our listeners to tell your friends about the rebroadcast of this program on Monday morning to hear about this.
Right. So thank you so much for being with us today, Ellen. It was really, really eye-opening. And I got to say, the book it's so engaging. I mean, I am, like, so drawn into it.
It is.
Into these characters. You know, it's so real. It's so vivid. You've done an amazing job.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So, Mom, do you have some closing words for
this
us today?
This is interesting. This is from Sitting Bull, who, of course, was an Indian chief back in the dawn of time. And he said, "Let us put our minds together and see what life we can make for our children."
Mm.
Amen.
So stay tuned now if you're listening on Friday to Planet Earth Wild, and also check out our rebroadcast Monday morning. And if you're listening on Monday, have a great week and see you next week. Merry Christmas next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.